All right, you guys. Welcome to the show. God dang it, clock. I wish I could hold you still for a minute while I can finish rereading this article. I've just been putting it off and putting it off, and then now here I am, live on the air, trying to reread this article. See, MJ Rosenberg's going to be on the show. He's quoted in here. It's at the New Yorker. Well, it's got a lot of different titles. I don't know why they've done it this way. Friends of Israel is one of the titles. Are American Jews Turning Against AIPAC is another one of the titles. I would call it an incomplete article that nonetheless is full of great anecdotes about the malign power of the Israel lobby in America. And I think the question about whether younger American Jews are less attached to Israel, it's in here. I think everybody kind of already knows that. And that's not really the point of the article, other than, you know, any young people reading this, Jewish or not, are going to be like, Jesus, are you kidding me? You know, in understanding the power of the Israel lobby in America. But really, it's just a list of a bunch of things that happened, things that are just maddening. You know, when you look at the power of the Israel lobby in the United States, it's pretty much unbelievable. And it's not a matter of more harm than good. It's nothing but harm. There's no good comes of it whatsoever. Not for the American people anyway. You know, I guess if you're a military dictator in Egypt, then it's great for you. But, you know, if you're a dead Gazan, not so much. An American taxpayer, inflation sufferer, not so much. Anyway, so I read it yesterday, and I should have taken notes the first time. Well, I was thinking, how am I going to get this lady on the air? She didn't even answer, of course, you know. Then, man, I can just get MJ on there. He's quoted in here. He used to work at AIPAC for a little while, way, way, way back in the day. And anyway, so I'll just get him on to talk about this. By the way, as long as I'm saying MJ Rosenberg's name and telling you that he's going to be on the show today, which is true, you should go and find, maybe I should try to find it for you here, as long as I'm talking about it. Man, it's going to be hard to come up with the correct keywords. Let's see, I think it would have been for Media Matters, first of all. Media Matters, Rosenberg, oh man. Let's see, I know, I'll go with the dates. Let's see, 1967, 1973, 1979 maybe? Peace. See, let me think of the keywords here. See, the point of it is, MJ wrote this article about how every time in Israeli history, the Warhawks wanted to do something, and the peaceniks said, no, don't do it, because these terrible consequences. Hey, there's a keyword. Consequences. Oh, what am I, on the wrong window here? Damn it, Bobby. God dang it. Consequences. How then, the peaceniks were right every time. Over and over and over again. And if only the Warhawks had listened to them, then the terrible things that happened wouldn't have happened, basically. Now, let me see. Search site at Media Matters for it. See, he used to write for them pretty exclusively there. Rosenberg, 67. Let me take 79 out of there. Ah, hell. I don't know. I'll ask MJ about it when he's on, see if I can come up with some better keywords. Man. I sure don't see it. Searching their website. Anyway, the point is, it was this great historical article by MJ Rosenberg. All about how the left doves in Israel were always right. Not just about what not to do, but why not to do it. Over and over and over again. And now look at the situation. It's horrible. And it was such a great article. I mean, he just proves his case. It's just he shows his case so well, you know? You'll like it. as soon as I can figure out what the hell it is. In fact, here, I'm going to email MJ at the break and ask him if he can find the link for me. He'll know the one I'm talking about. We've discussed it on the show before. In fact, I think I had him on long after the fact and had him go back and reread it and be prepared so we could go through it on the show and did a whole show on that article about how time after time, decade after decade, the peace left was right and the right war party was wrong and screwed the Israeli people and, of course, all of their innocent victims, especially in Palestine and in Lebanon. But anyway, all right, so MJ's going to be on the show, and I know that there's big controversy between the two staters and the one staters and a big thing, and if it was up to me, we'd all have a brisket barbecue, and Max and MJ and Phil Weiss and everybody all get along now. You're all a bunch of liberal Jews who want the best for humanity. Stop fighting. That's my opinion. Anyway, so I don't care about that. That's not really why I have him on either. I'm not really a hardliner on people's positions on one state or two or whatever kind of thing. Mostly I'm just an anti-interventionist from an American perspective on it. Really, I think the Israelis should get the best part of Germany. I don't think it's too late for that. And leave the poor Palestinians alone. Give them their country back. But, you know, whatever. That's just my opinion. But I'm not really all hell-bent on people's opinion about that. But what I am hell-bent on is the detriment, especially to the American people, for, first of all, the cost, the dollar cost for what we give the Israelis, and then the moral and physical and policy cost of what they do with the money and the weapons that we give them. You know, kill children and provoke terrorist attacks against New York City and stuff like that. That I kind of resent and try to highlight because I think it's sort of important. So anyway, that's really what I care about. And the power of the Israel lobby, and I've said this a lot of times on the show, and yes, Grant, I said it yesterday on the show, Grant Smith is absolutely right, that they break the law a lot. And this is not just a simple case of democracy. But then again, all power factions break the law. There's no law that applies to people who actually have political power in America. Give me a break. What do you think this is, a limited constitutional republic with a rule of law or something? That is a cruel joke. It's not even a cruel joke. It's a stupid joke. So never even mind the law. You know what? They're experts at democracy. The Israel lobby. And that's a lot of what we're going to hear MJ describe on the show today, is just how, man, they've got your congressman's ass better than you. So when he weighs, do I cross the Israel lobby or do I cross the people of the neighborhood? There's really just no question. You know? They've got the democracy game won. And what we need would be like for the Kochs to actually put peace first. And they're actually more or less pretty good on foreign policy, at least historically. But it's, you know, hardly their main issue. But that's what we would need, would be, you know, a huge, you know, Ross Perot level billionaire willing to finance a massive peace lobby in America to be the opposite of the war party. You know, they talk in this article about they sent a guy to Lubbock to find six Jews and say, guys, come on, get it together, meet every week, raise money, call yourselves citizens of Lubbock for a stronger relationship with Israel or whatever it is. Stay organized, stay on your congressman's case, be willing to threaten him because there's out-of-state money can be brought in at any time. Be willing to use carrots and sticks to make sure that your congressman stays on whatever Israel wants to do. And, you know, we could do that. I'm not much of a believer in the political process, but it seems like if only we had billions of dollars, then maybe we could have an America lobby. We could donate to the Council for the National Interest. They already got one going. Oh, yeah, Dar Jamail is going to be on to talk about America's war in Iraq, too, which was fought for Israel in the first place, of course. Oh, John Kerry's Mideast peace talks have gone nowhere. Hey, y'all, Scott Horton here for the Council for the National Interest at councilforthenationalinterest.org. U.S. military and financial support for Israel's permanent occupations of the West Bank and Gaza Strip is immoral, and it threatens national security by helping generate terrorist attacks against our country. And face it, it's bad for Israel, too. Without our unlimited support, they would have much more incentive to reach a lasting peace with their neighbors. It's past time for us to make our government stop making matters worse. Help support CNI at councilforthenationalinterest.org. All right, you guys, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. It's my show. Dar Jamail coming up to talk about the war in Iraq. The Islamic Caliphate, Shiistan, Kurdistan. What are we calling the Assad-controlled part of the nation that used to be called Syria? Do they have a new name for that yet? Yeah, that old map is gone, man. I don't know. I mean, I'm not saying 1,000% it'll never come back again, that old border, but yeah, it sure seems like it. Dang, MJ doesn't remember which article I'm talking about. I just need better keywords, man, so I can Google it right. Boy, this is just gonna bother me all damn day, too, if I don't think of it. Hey, listen, chat room guys, you gotta help me out. By the way, if you want to be a chat room guy or gal, stop by scotthorton.org/chat. That's where everybody's chatting. You guys gotta help me out, man. Actually, you know, it could be that maybe MJ's archive at Media Matters has been disappeared or something. I don't know. But he did this article where he went through the whole history of every war that the Israeli government got the Israeli people into, and their victims, and how every time the peacemongers were right when they warned that if you do this, then this is going to happen, and then that was what happened, and it was terrible, and then it helped set them up for the next crisis. Kind of like a tiny little America. Only even more dishonest, if you could believe that. But yeah, I know, it's hard to believe. Anyway, if anybody in the chat room could possibly help me find this dang article, then that would be great. It's like that time I couldn't think of the term statute of limitations and my brain almost exploded, and then finally I thought of it. Oh, statute of limitations. It's like that. It's going to bother me until I can think of the title or think of the article. I'm pretty sure it was at Media Matters. Maybe it wasn't. Anyway, enough. MJ Rosenberg on the Israel lobby and all that coming up. And, well, geez, let me just cover some more news because I don't think, you know, Israel news, I mean. Because I don't know if we're going to have time to talk about all that kind of stuff with MJ. First of all, they're saying that there's a long-term Gaza truce, that it's been agreed to, according to the Palestinians. And then, you know, but I had a tweet here from Shira Frinkle, who writes for BuzzFeed. But never mind that. She does real journalism, man. She's all right. I mean, she doesn't have my same, you know, spin on things or anything like that. But she does actual work. And she says here, just spoke to Palestinian official who said ceasefire deal reached in Cairo is extended truce, but wouldn't say long-term truce. So whatever that is. Last I heard from Eric Garris at antiwar.com, pretty much right before I went on the air, just a few minutes before going on the air, the Israelis have not confirmed this from their end yet. I sure hope that it's true. Let us all hope that it's true. Hamas ready for new Gaza ceasefire. No response from Israel yet. This is from yesterday. Both Islamic Jihad and Hamas are agreeing to the idea. This is news.antiwar.com. Israeli officials say that no decision has been made on the ceasefire call. And then Israeli warplanes pound Rafah border crossing. This is from yesterday. Hundreds were waiting to go into Egypt. Again, news.antiwar.com by Jason Ditz. In a move which could have caused a much larger civilian toll than it ultimately did, Israeli warplanes attacked the Rafah border crossing yesterday, hitting a departure hall full of hundreds of civilians trying to cross into Egypt. Fortunately, the attacks did not collapse the hall. Israel offered no explanation for the attack, which wounded only a handful of civilians, and the crossing has continued to function, in spite of the damage done by the airstrikes. What the hell is the point of that? Except just killing. They've got a crazy ass policy over there, just killing people. Oh, and here's something I didn't get to yesterday that's important to get to. First of all, let me just remind you, and you can go to antiwar.com and find this easily. Get on Twitter and find it pretty easily, too. If you have not seen the footage of the Israelis attacking and collapsing high-rise apartment complexes, apartment buildings in the Gaza Strip over the last few days, you got to go look at it. It's unreal. It's, well, I don't know. It's really something else. Go look, okay? All right, good. Now, Israel leader tries to link Hamas and Iraq extremists, ISIS, the Islamic State. And so this is just another measure. There's really not much to learn here other than to find another example of just how willing the Israeli government is to lie to you. How deaf and stupid they are to the obviousness of their own dishonesty and the long-term damage that they're doing to brand blue and white Star of David. It just stands for pile of blood-soaked lying killers. What? All you do is kill people and lie. All day long you lie and lie and lie. Here's a quick anecdote about Hamas from 2 years ago. There was a mosque where some guys started talking like bin Laden. I guess this was 3 years ago. The Hamas guys went in there and killed them to death. And said, now that you're dead, how much you love Osama now, you dead corpses. Yeah, that's how much Hamas is like Al-Qaeda. That's how much Hamas is like the Islamic State. They stand for election and win. They haven't done a suicide attack in more than 10 years. Not that I ever am justifying suicide terrorism against civilians at all. They are terrorists. But then again, you know who founded Israel? That's right, the ear gun. That's right, Yitzhak Shamir and Menachem Begin, they were civilian slaughtering terrorists. And they're the government of Israel. They love Fatah now. But what's Fatah? That's the PLO. They're civilian slaughtering terrorists too. But you know what? Sometimes you got to work with what you got to work with, the leadership of the other side in your state agreement. Look at all the violence the Israelis and the Americans have caused. Hamas and the PLO are still willing to talk with them. But now, what a hoax. What a stupid hoax. Hey, everybody. You know the guys who are running around in black masks, cutting people's heads off and machine gunning them all to death in ditches for being Shiites by the hundreds and hundreds and hundreds and hundreds and thousands across Iraq right now? Oh yeah, Hamas is just like them. Based on what? Based on nothing. Based on, yeah, they're Arabs and they're Sunnis. And Israel says so. I don't know who this is fooling anymore. It's looking pretty clear they would prefer that Hamas become more like ISIS so they could just drop a nuke on Gaza and be done with it. Kill every last baby there so they can steal it for themselves. They need better excuses, you know? Hey, all Scott here. If you're like me, you need coffee. Lots of it. And you probably prefer it tastes good, too. Well, let me tell you about Darren's Coffee Company at darrenscoffee.com. Darren Marion is a natural entrepreneur who decided to leave his corporate job and strike out on his own, making great coffee. And Darren's Coffee is now delivering right to your door. Darren gets his beans direct from farmers around the world, all specialty, premium grade, with no filler. Hey, the man just wants everyone to have a chance to taste this great coffee. Darren's Coffee. Order now at darrenscoffee.com. Use promo code Scott and save $2. darrenscoffee.com. All right, you guys, welcome back to the show. So I got a Ukraine, a couple stories from Ukraine I got to cover for you today. I got a giant police state section here. Okay, I can put aside Israel-Palestine for now until MJ joins us again. Oh, no, I can't because he sent me this. The lobby's shame at the Huffington Post. And I don't think this is the one. But I do think he has kind of a minor, lesser version of the same story within this article, where he goes through, he says, the status quo lobby is almost always wrong. And it's more or less the same story that he told better in a different place somewhere, I believe. But I'm really just going from the picture in my brain, which is telling me it was at Media Matters and that it was really on this subject all the way through. But my brain has got problems, you know, so it might not be right. Anyway, but here, he makes the point perfectly. The Lobby's Shame by MJ Rosenberg at the Huffington Post. The status quo lobby is almost always wrong, he says. And, well, we'll talk about that more. But, yeah, good old MJ. He'll be on soon. And then, okay, so let's see. Well, yeah, and I said they're saying there's a truce, not just a ceasefire, but some sort of medium-length truce is supposed to break out tonight in Gaza. Again, I hope that's right. Okay, so now to the news from the caliphate. Assad, no U.S. airstrikes without Syrian coordination. So Assad says, yeah, America, you can bomb in Syria. And America says, yeah, we want to bomb in Syria. But Assad says, you can't bomb in Syria unless you coordinate it with me. Or else I won't give you permission. And then in that case, it's an attack on a sovereign state rather than you helping me out. So, you know, this is what happens when your president, the leadership of the entire Congress, the entire National Security Council, the CIA, and all of the other 17 intelligence agencies are all guilty of high treason. Guilty of high treason because for the past 2 years, they have been supporting the jihad. They have been working with the Saudis, the Qataris, the Jordanians, and the Turks to funnel weapons and money to the Sunni-based insurgency against the Baathists in Syria. And so now they're trying to turn that thing around, but the boat sure is creaky as they try to kind of paper over how they're flip-flopping on this policy. And they just can't admit that if you're looking for a moderate in Syria, his name is Bashar al-Assad. Yes, he's a ruthless, murderous, blood-soaked dictator. Maybe he's not a moderate, but he's the centrist. But, you know, John McCain gets to be called a moderate, even though he's the most extreme human on the planet, right? So, as long as he's a centrist, he's a moderate. Well, Bashar al-Assad is where many, if not most, Sunnis in Syria, along with the Shia, the Kurds, the Alawites, who are kind of Shia but kind of not too, and all the Christian sects agree. Where they converge is they want Assad and a Baathist government to protect them from the suicide bomber prisoner beheaders. And that's been their position this whole time, that America and its sock puppet satellite states have been fomenting this revolution in Syria. Now they got bin Laden incarnate, declaring himself the caliph in Mosul and Raqqa and all the land between. And so, as the DC people say, the optics are a little bit screwed up here. People paying attention are beginning to say, wait a minute, a year ago you wanted to go to war against the state army that's hemming these guys in as best he can in the West? And now what you're saying makes sense, that you would rather bomb these ISIS guys. Not that I'm supporting that, but I'm just saying at least that makes sense. Since ISIS is just Al-Qaeda in Iraq under a new name, that's all it is Zarqawi's group. The worst of the Sunni-based insurgency from the American occupation of Iraq. That's all they are, only way grown up. And inheriting the weapons that David Petraeus gave all the Sunnis for their awakening so-called movement against Al-Qaeda back in 07. And those he gave the Iraqi army to help them, too. And they got oil. So I don't know how much money. I read an article the other day said they're making about $3 million a day off of ransom and from kidnappings and from black market oil sales. Could be more, could be less, I don't know, but they're making some money. And a lot of that land's just desert. I mean, their state is just up and down the Tigris and the Euphrates, but everything to the south of there until you get to Baghdad is just open desert anyway. So there's not much control to be had out there, you know? Anyway, but the reports are that the U.S. has been giving information to the Assad regime by way of the Germans. And now, according to the Associated Press, through Russia, America is giving the targeting data to Moscow to give to Damascus. Oh, and they're giving it to the Russian and Iranian and all this time USian-backed government in Baghdad, too, to funnel it to Assad. Because they can't admit that here they've been waging this rebellion, this Mujahideen rebellion against Assad, the secular Baathist, fascist, clean-shaven, chin-having dictator of Syria, when he's their number one ally in the region on this issue. Just like anyone, and I'm not talking from a libertarian point of view here or non-interventionist point of view, but just any warmonger, any cruel, you know, American pro-war, you know, nationalist, but just who doesn't have some perverted vested interest, but is just looking at it from a national interest point of view, would say, go back in time, support Saddam and support Assad against these guys to overthrow Saddam and turn the entire Sunni triangle into the Wild Wild West for 14 years. Real, real bad idea. You know, and that was what, you know, and I'm not really trying to pat myself on the back, but just try to explain that this has been known all along. That since the dawn of the Arab Spring and the dawn of American intervention in Syria, I've had the likes of Eric Margolies and Patrick Coburn and David Enders and others on the show explaining exactly what was happening. From the very beginning, from 2011, Eric Margolies had sources in French intelligence saying, yeah, we got special forces on the ground. We're working with Prince Bandar and the Saudis to bring Mujahideen to come and fight the war. And hell, it was in McClatchy. I don't think this was a David Enders piece. I think it might have been Jonathan Landay reporting. I believe, I'd have to go check, but I believe as far back as 2011. Where the Obama administration themselves are saying, well, you know, we're a little bit reluctant to help these guys here because this al-Nusra front is basically just al-Qaeda in Iraq. Yeah. Of course, I have my clip. I always I like to play this clip. I don't play it enough. Here's Hillary Clinton from the beginning of 2012. But we were talking about this. This is February or March of 2012. But we were talking about this the whole time through 2011 as well, as soon as the intervention in Syria started.
So I think, Wyatt, you know, despite the great pleas that we hear from those people who are, Al-Qaeda, Zawahiri is supporting the opposition in Syria. Are we supporting Al-Qaeda in Syria?
Yes, Hamas? Yes. This whole time. Now we're switching sides again. Back to the Baathists. Time to dig up Saddam. This part of the Scott Horton Show is sponsored by Audible.com. And right now, if you go to audibletrial.com/Scott Horton Show, you can get your first audiobook for free. Of course, I'm recommending Michael Swanson's book, The War State, The Cold War Origins of the Military-Industrial Complex and the Power Elite. Maybe you've already bought The War State in paperback, but you just can't find the time to read it. Well, now you can listen while you're out marching around. Get the free audiobook of The War State by Michael Swanson, produced by Listen and Think Audio, at audibletrial.com/Scott Horton Show. All right, y'all, you know what I'm going to do? Well, first of all, here's that Hillary clip again, just so everybody's got it. And then I got the Ben Swan clip that I even interviewed him about this at the time. But I haven't played this. I don't play this as often as I play the Hillary one. But anyway, first of all, here just for footnote's sake, from early spring, 2012, Hillary Clinton on CBS News, the entire propaganda was, why aren't we helping the people of Syria? The people, meaning the Saudi-backed Mujahideen, Al-Qaeda, suicide bomber killers. Why aren't we doing enough to help them against the secular, clean-shaven, minority Baathist dictator? Elected dictator. Hillary loves that kind of thing in Yemen, for example, no problem. Bashar al-Assad. So she says, well, you know, we really would like to overthrow Bashar al-Assad because, of course, there is no higher value than whatever Israel wants. However,
we know al-Qaeda, Zawahiri, is supporting the opposition in Syria. Are we supporting al-Qaeda in Syria? Hamas is now supporting the opposition. Are we supporting Hamas in Syria?
Yeah. And no, Hamas doesn't have nothing to do with what's going on up there. They're close to the Muslim Brotherhood, which has basically been completely marginalized from the fight in Syria by the veterans of the Iraq War. The veterans of al-Qaeda in Iraq. They're the al-Nusra Front. And the only difference between the al-Nusra Front and the Islamic State now is that the Islamic State broke off from the al-Nusra Front because Zawahiri said, go back to Iraq. And they said, what's Iraq? What are you talking about, old man? And you can't tell us what to do. You're hiding in a basement in Pakistan somewhere. And we're actually over here killing people. So what? And look, everybody, you see what a sellout he is? Zawahiri says there's such a thing as Syria and Iraq. Well, we say there's not. Welcome to Sunni Stan. And so it's a political fight. Tactical. But otherwise, they're the exact same thing. It's just Bin Ladenites only with a country now, instead of waiting to have a country later. Anyway, so here's Hillary also elaborating to CBS News that, yeah, you know, there's not much of a separate group of civil society to put in power here.
So I think why, you know, despite the great pleas that we hear from those people who are being ruthlessly assaulted by Assad. If you're a military planner or if you're a secretary of state and you're trying to figure out, do you have the elements of an opposition that is actually viable? We don't see that.
Right. There you go. So then when by that time, early 2012, and the al-Nusra Front suicide bomber prisoner beheaders who attack women and children at their schools were the supermajority of the insurgency there, how in the world could she have continued down that same policy that she herself right there completely debunked all by herself? Now here, let me find Swan here. Two N's in Swan, not too bad. Here's Ben Swan interviewing Barack Obama not long after that quote from Hillary Clinton. Again, I'm 99% sure this is from spring 2012.
I share that concern, and so what we've done is to say we will provide non-lethal assistance to Syrian opposition leadership that are committed to a political transition, committed to an observance of human rights. We're not going to just dive in and get involved with a civil war that, in fact, involves some elements of people who are genuinely trying to get a better life, but also involve some folks who would, over the long term, do the United States harm.
All right, so I'm sorry that didn't include Swan's question. But anyway, that's Obama. Boy, he's almost like Bill Clinton with his levels of BS you got to sift through to get to what he's saying. But what he's saying is, you're right, Ben Swan. We are not about to get up to our eyeballs in this civil war where a lot of the people doing the fighting against the dictator that we also hate are some pretty bad guys. So, geez, I don't know. He's not disputing Ben Swan's facts. Actually, he's trying to dispute that, oh, come on, I'm not backing the bad guys. I'm trying to back the good guys. But in doing so, his excuse is, but yeah, you're right, there are a lot of bad guys running around there too, yeah? We don't know what to do. And of course, Obama did continue to support them all along, mostly by buying them trucks and giving them money and other aid and coordinating arms and money from others. But so that's not even plausible deniability, okay? When every country in the region that is a sock puppet of America is sending money and weapons. Now, obviously, the Saudis and the Qataris have their own interests and back different militias, Arar al-Sham here or al-Nusra there or whatever. They're all American sock puppet satellite states. And if America, if Obama had had a policy that said, hey, you listen to me, Prince Bandar, JSOC is coming for you, dude, if you keep this up, then that would have all ended. It would have been over. If America had told Turkey and Qatar and all the sheikhs of the Middle East, Kuwait, the Arabian sheikhs, you're not supporting this jihad against Assad. And we don't care what you think of Assad. He's helping keep Al-Qaeda down, and that's all we care about, and so screw you. But nope. And the CIA, according to the Washington Post and the New York Times, even, their admissions, the CIA is coordinating the whole thing all along anyway, trying to. Here's John McCain talking about, yeah, no, we vet these rebels. It's all about the vetting process with, you know, the vetting that we do and everything.
Well, by identifying those people who are on our side, we can identify who these people are. We can help the right people.
Yeah, and then he went and met with the Northern Storm Brigade, which you may have seen bogus pictures going around of McCain supposedly meeting with Baghdadi and supposedly meeting with the former, now deceased spokesman for ISIS. That's not right. That's just Twitter nonsense. But what he did do was he met with the Free Syrian Army leadership, Idris, who has no credibility whatsoever. You can just look at him and tell he's been living, feeding off a CIA trough, quite literally, for many years. They're all just a bunch of big fat expats on foreign intelligence payrolls. And then the actual fighters that he was with were from the Northern Storm Brigade, which ended up being variously chased off, killed, and or absorbed by al-Nusra and then ISIS later on. But if you just, and I'm sorry I'm a broken record on this, but you know, it seems like a relevant point to make to me. If you just go and Google Northern Storm Brigade, one of the first things you get is a Time magazine reporter interview, video interview of these guys before John McCain ever went to meet them. That was published online and in Time magazine before John McCain ever went to meet them. And well, actually, I don't know what was in the magazine. Sure as hell is on their website. And anyway, in the video, at least one of them says, yeah, I'm a proud veteran of the Iraq War. That's right. But, you know, anyway, America and me agree this time that this Assad guy's got to go. Yeah, well, probably agreed with you about Saddam having to go back then, too, huh? Again, with the Saddam with the clean-shaven chin. It's kind of in the way of those with a bin Ladenite agenda. And so, anyway, that was John McCain himself and his own people and their vetting of the rebels. They went and met guys who had, it's fair to assume, had killed Americans in the last war in Iraq. And then, of course, they were also later exposed as the kidnappers of some Shiite pilgrims. At least their same group was. I don't know if it was the very men on the porch with them. But anyway, the Northern Storm Brigade, those guys were the moderates. Oh, yeah, they also used to fight for Zarqawi in Iraq. And anyway, al-Nusra is all but gone now. It's just being folded into the Islamic State. Because the fight, I mean, and there are still faction fight problems at the higher levels, at the leadership levels, but the fighters are picking a winner. And anyway, so, I'm sorry, man, here, let me blaze through some headlines here. Again, America funneling their intelligence through Iraq, Germany, and Russia to get it to Assad, to fight ISIS. Here's the thing I didn't get a chance to go through, and it's all based on official sources, but it's at the Washington Post. It's called, Here's Everything the U.S. Military Has Hit with Airstrikes in Iraq. Prothero did say they were being pretty open about it so far, so that's worth the read. And then, man, now I'm out of time, but over 500 killed as ISIS seizes key North Syria airbase. That's from 2 days ago.
Hey, y'all, Scott Horton here for WallStreetWindow.com.
Mike Swanson knows his stuff. He made a killing running his own hedge fund and always gets out of the stock market before the government-generated bubbles pop. Which is, by the way, what he's doing right now. Selling all his stocks and betting on gold and commodities. Sign up at WallStreetWindow.com and get real-time updates from Mike on all his market moves. It's hard to know how to protect your savings and earn a good return in an economy like this. Mike Swanson can help. Follow along on paper and see for yourself. WallStreetWindow.com. All right, you guys, welcome back. Well, shoot. Dar Jamail ain't where he's supposed to be. Hey, Dar, can you hear me? Hey, Dar's next door neighbor, are you listening? Maybe you could holler out the window. Turn on your Skype, Dar. Scott's trying to call you. All right. Well, anyway, maybe we'll have Dar Jamail later on the show. Guess what? New extra special surprise guest will be joining us. If not, Dar. We're going to be talking with Jeff Patterson from BradleyManning.org all about the new lawyers. And their attempt to get Chelsea Manning out of prison, where she is doing 35 years in the brig for the heroic act of liberating the Iraq and Afghan war logs, the State Department cables, the Guantanamo files, for being the source, for providing the source for thousands of important news articles that have been published since about the malevolence of the American Empire and its sock puppets around the world. The American hero, Chelsea Manning. Well, anyway, Jeff Patterson's going to be on and just give us the news. So that's good. So I'm writing that down so that I don't space out. Okay, good. So, and then, I don't know, man. Dar is still, he's grayed out, dude. He's grayed out. We'll see what happens with that. That's all right, because you know what? I got a ton of stuff to talk about. Well, I gotta definitely make sure and get back to Oklahoma City today. But let me just run through my ISIS stories here real quick. Maybe I'll keep talking if I find something very important to talk about. But here's everything the U.S. military has hit with airstrikes in Iraq so far by Dan Lamoth at the Washington Post. I'm not saying it's everything, but I'm saying it's an attempt to be comprehensive. Everything we know about the airstrikes so far there at the Post by this guy, so worth looking at. U.S. and Iran reports Eli Lake. I know, roll your eyes, but I don't think there's really anything controversial about these facts very much. Well, I don't know. Actually, we just reported otherwise from the... I'm not sure who Business Insider was quoting here about the funneling the information through Iraq. Anyway, I don't know. Eli Lake is saying U.S. and Iran both hit ISIS, ignore each other. We're both fighting, just like America and Iran worked all along from 2003 through 2011 to install the Dawa Party and Supreme Islamic Council and Muqtada al-Sadr and their party, the United Iraqi Alliance, in power. The whole time, they wouldn't talk to him. They wouldn't talk to him. The whole time, they're fighting a war for him. Now, here again, America is serving as shock troops for Iran. But won't even dignify them with, yes, we are your greatest benefactor in the whole wide world. You know? It's kind of strange. Why does America support the Islamic State and al-Nusra suicide bomber prisoner beheaders in Syria this whole time? To weaken Iran, of course. Iran, who is 1,000% more powerful than before because George Bush invaded Iraq and gave all the land between Baghdad and Basra to him. Yeah, the same land where no bin Ladenites existed. The same land where Thomas Friedman, the leading public intellectual in America, said would be a perfect target for America's rage after September 11th. Where all Shia live. Between Baghdad and Basra, huh? You're going to blow that up, huh? No, that'll work out great. Leading public intellectual in America, they call it. Anyway, so here we are again. America and Iran and Russia and Bashar al-Assad all on the same side and refusing to admit it. All right. Crazy. And then, oh yeah, by the way, how did I forget this? I was just laughing right as the music was starting to play. I was stopping laughing, not from the Onion clip, but from this, from NBC News. An American has been killed fighting with ISIS in Syria. Well, what's so hilarious about that, Scott Horton? You're asking. According to NBC News, his name is Douglas MacArthur McCain. Douglas MacArthur McCain. He's named after the two worst warmongers in American history. Wow. Okay, I know Douglas MacArthur. Well, you know, you kind of got to admit, man, if it had been Robert Taft with MacArthur as running mate, and then Taft had turned around and died, and then MacArthur had been the president, there would have been a nuclear war with Russia and China, right? I mean, is that really in dispute? Douglas MacArthur McCain, following John McCain's lead, going to fighting with the rebels against Assad in Syria. Someone just tweeted, John's nephew? I don't know yet, but someone tell me, please, yes. Please, yes, someone tell me that it's even John McCain's third cousin twice removed. Anything. Come on, world, help me out on this one, man. Tell me that's even really his name. God almighty. All right. Well, anyway. Iran sent soldiers to fight in Iraq. According to Al Jazeera, hundreds of Iranian troops have crossed the border. Oh, and then you know what? I was reading this on my phone earlier. I forget if I retweeted it or what. Can I find it again? Iran sent soldiers to fight in Iraq. There was another one along these lines that was better. I'll have to look on my Twitter feed and see if I can find it from this morning. It's a problem with tweeting from so many different places all the time. Forget where I read stuff. Oh, it was about the Badr Brigade. That's what it was. In fact, let me just Google News Badr Brigade. Badr. Oh, and it was Eastern. I can never spell the name of that province in my life. In Google News here, Badr. That's not it. That's an entire different story about somebody named Badr commenting on the chaos going on in Libya, which maybe I'll get a chance to fill you in on here in a minute, too. All right, well, gunmen killed dozens at Sunni mosque in Iraq, raising fears of sectarian war. And as Mitchell Prothero, this is from last week, but Prothero said on the show that the Al-Haq, whatever it's called, something Al-Haq, I always forget the first part, that they denied it. But here they're mentioning it's, oh, Diyala province is the one I was trying to think of there. It's basically being run by the Badr Brigade. Well, what's the Badr Brigade? That's the militia of the Supreme Council for Islamic Revolution in Iraq, who were the Iraqi traitors who lived in Iran for 30 years, from the time that Jimmy Carter hired Saddam Hussein to invade Iran all the way through 2003. They took the enemy's side. And then when Bush invaded in 2003, he brought them in and made the Badr Brigade the Iraqi army. I guess they feel a little bit more freedom to maneuver in their militia clothes instead of their American-style fatigues. There you go. The leader of a powerful Shiite militia, the Badr Brigades, mobilized his fighters Friday to liberate the northern Shiite town of Amirli, which has been besieged by Islamic State militants. Man, I need to get Prothero and also our friend David Enders is back in Iraq as well. And I think reporting from Diyala. I'm working on getting that. Civil War breaking out all like crazy in former Iraq right now. And what's the future status of Kirkuk? The Kurds are holding it, but tenuously. SAS and JSOC on the ground. News.antiwar.com. Hey, y'all, Scott Horton here for The Future of Freedom, the monthly journal of the Future of Freedom Foundation. Edited by libertarian purist Sheldon Richman, The Future of Freedom brings you the best of our movement. Featuring articles by Richman, Jacob Hornberger, James Bovard, and many more, The Future of Freedom stands for peace and liberty and against our criminal world empire and Leviathan state. Subscribe today. It's just $25 per year for the back pocket size print edition, $15 per year to read it online. That's The Future of Freedom at fff.org/subscribe. Peace and freedom. Thank you. I don't know, man. Too good to be true, dude. Right? That the guy's name is McCain? Is this a psyop? No, I don't know. Douglas MacArthur McCain. The dead wannabe Bin Ladenite. Yep, well, these things happen. Too bad for you, kind of. Not that anyone cares. All right, now listen, I got to talk to you about the Oklahoma City bombing. You know what? I was talking with Eric Garris, and Eric Garris said to me, you know, people don't even know what the Oklahoma bombing is. People don't even know what that is. What? Wait a minute, that was the hugest thing in the whole wide world that happened. You don't remember that? The biggest thing in the whole wide world? Oh, yeah, I remember. I mean, some people do, but it was 20 years ago. It was a long time ago to a lot of people. A lot of young people born, raised up since then. No idea. It's like something that happened in the Eisenhower years to me or something like that, you know? Or, I don't know, Johnson. Kennedy. Ancient history. But here's the thing of it. And this has been the thing of it from the very first day for me. And that is that they're lying. They're just lying. And they're caught lying a million times. And the truth is that the neo-Nazis did it. And almost to a man, they were at least at one point, if not currently, federal informants and flip states witnesses. And so the government let them get away with it. Because otherwise the government would have looked bad. And that is the best case scenario. The worst case scenario is that they cooked up the whole damn thing. Because they're trying to discredit the post-Waco radical right, angry, confiscated, foreclosed farm, firearms, having Clinton hating white men. And so they needed to cook up something. Not that they necessarily meant for the attack to take place, even if it was a sting. I believe that they meant to thwart it, but they were had. That's, I believe, the most plausible explanation, as written up by Roger Charles and Andrew Gumbel in the book Oklahoma City, for the reason there were two Ryder trucks. There were two Ryder trucks because the Nazis knew that the feds were following them, so they got another Ryder truck and they left the GPS on the first one, whatever tracking radio tracking device they had. They got another Ryder truck, and they went ahead and did their business anyway. That's why the bomb squad was there for a couple hours that morning and then left. And McVeigh showed up at 9 o'clock. But they had all kinds of prior knowledge. The FBI had, I mean, the ATF had their own plan for a raid at Elohim City, where all the neo-Nazis were living, based on the reporting of their informant, Carol Howe, about what these guys were up to. And the FBI, led by Tom Ricks, the spokesman for the FBI during the Waco siege and massacre, he's the guy that shut down the ATF investigation into the Nazis at Elohim City and said, we'll handle this, and then he didn't handle nothing. And 169 people were killed. And most of the people involved in the plot got away with it. And the reason this is news, 19 years later, unbelievable. The reason this is news now is because Jesse Trenadue has been fighting in court for the video of the attack, that there's very, very strong reason to believe the government has, or at least did have, even if they have obstructed justice and destroyed it, footage which shows McVeigh and an accomplice drive up in the yellow Ryder truck before the attack, and shows them both getting out of the truck, etc., etc. And so there's a judge out in Utah who's been allowing this to proceed and wants to get to the bottom of it. And during the FISA trial, where Trinidad is trying to get access to the government's records, he said his star witness, an FBI agent who was in the PatCon investigation, that was the code name for Patriot Conspiracy, was the name or shorthand for Patriot Conspiracy, which was the title of the FBI operation, Infiltrating the Radical Right. And he said that his FBI star witness, a former FBI officer, a star witness, was intimidated and threatened to not show up in court. And so the judge says, well, so what's the truth of that? And the government says, nuh-uh, he just didn't want to go. All right, so the judge said, resolve this. I want an internal investigation. I want the results of it by November, whatever. The fight continues. The judge has learned from years of this that Jesse Trinidad is right and that the government is lying and covering up. And that's why Jesse Trinidad has been so successful there. He's got this federal judge is way out in Utah who's independent enough and who has learned that, man, you guys are so full of it. When I said bring me the documents, maybe I didn't make myself clear. I meant I am going to put you in jail if you don't bring me the documents. Now do you understand me? Oh, yes, sir, they sputter. This has been going on for years. And the reason that Jesse Trinidad has standing to sue is because the feds murdered his brother, Kenneth. And they murdered his brother, Kenneth, because they thought that he was Richard Lee Guthrie, who was very likely John Doe number two that day in the truck with Timothy McVeigh, or at least was very likely involved in the plot. And it's very, very likely that the feds thought that he was John Doe number two, whether he really was or not. And Kenneth Trinidad was simply in the wrong place. I said Guthrie. I'm sorry if I screwed up my names. They thought Guthrie was John Doe too. Yeah, that's right. And Kenneth Trinidad was the innocent bystander who had the wrong color hair and the wrong build and the wrong truck and the wrong dragon tattoo and was mistaken for Guthrie. And then, I guess, apparently, when he wouldn't admit he was Guthrie and answer their questions, they killed him in his federal cell. Or maybe they just decided he was Guthrie and they killed him to shut him up so he wouldn't tell the story of how he and McVeigh had done the bombing together. We don't know exactly. But we do know for certain that he didn't kill himself. And there's, I can't go through the entire story. There's a lot of reason to believe that's why they killed him. It was because they thought he was Guthrie John Doe too. And Guthrie, the real Guthrie, ended up dead in his prison cell just a few months later as well. Big surprise. And you know what? If you think this is crazy right-wing conspiracy kookery, then I will ask you to go and look at YouTube at the New America Foundation. Here's your keywords. New America Foundation. Gumbel. Just like Barney Gumbel on The Simpsons or Bryant Gumbel on The Today Show. Andrew Gumbel, New America Foundation, Oklahoma City. And there you will see a very mainstream acceptable reporter explaining to a very mainstream acceptable terrorism expert, Peter Bergen, about what really happened here. And about the decision that the Department of Justice made, just as clear as this. This is so well reported, it's undeniable. They decided, do we want to risk the McVeigh prosecution by looking for other guilty people? No. They had a big fight about it. And the side that said, nah, let's just prosecute McVeigh and Nichols won. And so they let everybody else go free. And it's a true fact. You can read about it in The Guardian today. You hate government? One of them libertarian types? Or maybe you just can't stand the president, gun grabbers, or warmongers. Me too. That's why I invented LibertyStickers.com. Well, Rick owns it now, and I didn't make up all of them, but still, if you're driving around and want to tell everyone else how wrong their politics are, there's only one place to go. LibertyStickers.com has got your bumper covered. Left, right, libertarian, empire, police state, founders quote, central banking. Yes, bumper stickers about central banking. Lots of them. And, well, everything that matters. LibertyStickers.com. Everyone else's stickers suck. All right, y'all. Well, I screwed up. I don't have MJ's number. Or maybe I have it here somewhere. I gotta keep looking for it. Yes, I am terrible at doing radio sometimes. Here we go. Here's Thomas Friedman saying about how we ought to... well, you figure it out.
Now that the war is over and there's some difficulty with the peace, was it worth doing?
Well, I think it was unquestionably worth doing, Charlie. And I think that looking back, I now certainly feel I understand more what the war was about. We needed to go over there, basically, and take out a very big stick right in the heart of that world and burst that bubble. And there was only one way to do it. And what they needed to see was American boys and girls going house to house from Basra to Baghdad, and basically saying, which part of this sentence don't you understand? You don't think, you know, we care about our open society? You think this bubble fantasy, we're just going to let it grow? Well, suck on this, okay? That, Charlie, was what this war was about. We could have hit Saudi Arabia. It was part of that bubble. Could have hit Pakistan. We hit Iraq because we could. That's the real truth.
Oh, my God. I still love how Charlie Rose says, okay. hey, it's the Scott Horton Show. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show. Hey, not that there's anything wrong with that. But really, Charlie, Tom Friedman, come on. You could do better. Yeah, it's my show, the Scott Horton Show. And our first guest today, because I never did get a hold of Dar, it's our friend MJ Rosenberg. Hi, MJ. How are you doing?
Okay, so how are you?
I'm doing great. Welcome back to the show.
Thank you.
Very happy to have you here, and happy to see your name quoted and what you had to say here in this great New Yorker article.
Yeah, it's a great
piece. Which
goes
by many titles, Friends of Israel and or Are American Jews Turning Against AIPAC? And I have so many questions to ask you about all the great stuff in this article. But first, I actually wanted to ask you about your newest, I think it's your newest blog that I saw yesterday, about your own history at AIPAC, back when you worked there a long time ago. I guess it was after that, your time on Capitol Hill,
right.
where you and a senator you were working for, I believe Carl Levin, got tangled up with the Israeli government, the Israel lobby, and William Safire at the New York Times. And
right.
I think that it was... interesting and worth talking about for the same thing, for the same reasons you wrote about it. It's a great little window into how this works even back then. So I was hoping you could tell us that story first here.
Sure. It was in 1988, and I was a foreign policy aide to Senator Carl Levin of Michigan. And he asked me to prepare a letter to the Secretary of State of the United States, whose name was George Shultz, decrying the fact that the Prime Minister of Israel had just said that under no circumstances was Israel giving up territory. And what Levin wanted from me was to draft a letter that said, well, Mr. Secretary of State, regardless of what the Prime Minister of Israel says, it is the policy of the United States government that Israel be required to exchange land for peace, and that this language by the Prime Minister is not acceptable. So I drafted the letter, and then Levin is a big rewriter, which, you know, he does his job. So he rewrote the letter, but it was still basically what I said and what he wanted. And then Levin decided he would get other senators to sign it. So we got 30 senators to sign it with him, including people like Ted Kennedy and Patrick Moynihan. And I can't remember any, you know, now, but those were big names I remember. And I hand-delivered it to Secretary of State, to Shultz, up at night in his office at the State Department. And we were going to keep it all pretty secret. I don't know why, but Levin wanted it to be secret. He wanted just to do this. And but one of the other senators leaked it. And that this was on a Friday. And on that Sunday, the lead story in the New York Times was that 30 senators criticized the Prime Minister of Israel for saying that Israel would not give up land for a peace treaty. The lead article, I mean, it was huge. And they also reprinted the whole letter, and it was gigantic. And Levin's temerity and daring to criticize the Israeli government in a letter to his own Secretary of State caused the lobby to go crazy. And, they got all these phone calls, and all these people who gave Levin money were calling up and saying, I'm finished with him. How dare he criticize the prime minister, blah, 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 blah. But the main part thing that I write about in this story was that, you know, usually in the cases where a member of Congress do something, you don't go after the staffer. And I was not a prominent staffer. I mean, I wasn't someone like I am now where I'm known for my views. I wasn't known for my views. I had private views, and I just worked on Capitol Hill, which is where I did for 20 years. And when you're up there, you don't express yourself publicly except, through the member of Congress you happen to work for. Mm-hmm. But this being the lobby, they came after me. What happened was I got a call from the leading New York Times columnist. His name was William Sapphire, who called up, and I didn't believe he wanted to talk to me. In fact, at first I said, a senator's not here. He said, no, I'm calling for you. Okay. Why he was calling? Because he had heard that Levin hadn't really written the letter. I said, no, I drafted the letter. And he said, no, that's not what I heard at all. I heard that this letter is really was designed by the Labor Party in Israel, which in those days was pro-peace, to bring down the government of Israel, the right-wing government of Israel, and that Levin and I were just tools of the Labor Party. And he was going to write that in his column. And he was going to expose me as an agent of the Israel Labor Party. And how would that look for me? And that could cost me my job. And which was true. You're not allowed to be an agent for a foreign political party. And if I was, quote unquote, exposed to the New York Times, that would have finished me off. Well, it was, I was on the phone for like a half an hour. And then at the end of things, I apparently convinced him. And he said, well, he's going to write the article and just say that we serve the interests of the Labor Party. But he's not going to say the part about the Labor Party having written this letter.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting that he's accusing you of being an affront for the opposition out of power at the time, when he's actually acting as an agent for the government of Israel at the time.
Exactly. And he's a journalist. And so then he said, so I was grateful that he was not going to write these lies, because even if they're lies, we all know that wouldn't have mattered much. So, and then the last thing he said, all right, then, he said, but let me tell you one thing. If I find out that you lied to me, if I find out that you really did this, whether I find out a year from now, 5 years from now, or 10 years from now, your life will not be worth living.
God,
and then he hung up the phone. Well, I was really scared. I was young. I was in my 30s. And it was just like, whoa. I mean, it was pretty awful. And subsequently, a friend of mine, an Israeli friend of mine, told me the background of the whole thing was that the person who told Sapphire that it was me who wrote the letter at the behest of the Israel Labor Party was Israel's ambassador to the United Nations in New York, whose name was Benjamin Netanyahu.
Oh, man. All right, stop right there. We got to take this break, MJ. I'm sorry. We'll be right back. Hey, all, Scott Horton here. It's always safe to say that one should keep at least some of your savings in precious metals as a hedge against inflation. And if this economy ever does heat back up and the banks start expanding credit, rising prices could make metals a very profitable bet. Since 1977, Robertson Roberts Brokerage Inc. has been helping people buy and sell gold, silver, platinum, and palladium, and they do it well. They're fast, reliable, and trusted for more than 35 years. And they take Bitcoin. Call Robertson Roberts at 1-800-874-9760 or stop by rrbi.co. I'm sorry, back to MJ in one moment, but I just can't help myself. From BuzzFeed, there's a new ad running in the Washington Post, signed on by Executive Director Anthony Romero of the ACLU and a bunch of other prominent progressives, calling for a federal czar to oversee local police in America. That's right. There's only one excuse, one response to federally subsidized militarization of your local police, and that's to finally turn them into the SS under direct national presidential control from now on. Go ahead and get a pistol and blow your brains out. America is over. Over. Anyway. Talking with MJ Rosenberg about the power of the Israel lobby in the United States and this great article that ran in the New Yorker here. And it's really notable for its admissions, but we won't dwell on those. There's so much important stuff in here. And where we left off, it was Netanyahu who made up a lie and ratted you out to Sapphire. Sapphire apparently believed you that he was being lied to, because why would anybody believe anything that Benjamin Netanyahu says, MJ? And so you got away. You escaped by the skin of your teeth back then when you were a staffer on Capitol Hill. But just a little bit of a slice of life of how the Israel lobby operates in Washington, D.C. And now, I guess I want to ask you a broad question here, if you know, off the top of your head, if you can remember and think back to reading this new article in the New Yorker. What really stood out to you as the most important thing that people need to understand? I think, you know, the question of whether nowadays American Jews are kind of changing their mind about AIPAC and Israel, that kind of thing, that's sort of beside the point to me. There's so much about the actual operation of the lobby and the measure of its influence in America to talk about, you know? But what do you think is most notable?
Well, I think that the editors of the New Yorker, you know, they made the headline or the title imply that AIPAC is weakening. And they had one instance in the article talking about AIPAC's inability to block Iran, negotiations over Iran's nuclear program as evidence that it's getting weaker. But when taking the whole article, just the whole thing together, to me what struck me is how incredibly powerful they are. I just saw that, you know, I thought that the article itself was undermined the title of the article. It's, yeah, so yes, I think it's true that, and it quotes Shimon Peres even saying that young Jews and young people in general are totally turned off by Israel these days, but I don't think that matters. What matters is the money and the PACs. And the thing that's really terrific about the article is that the author, Connie Brook, explains how the money is raised and how the money is bundled, and it's not coming through PACs. And she also points out that there's no way to track the money. AIPAC will often say, well, even if we control the PACs, which we don't, all the PACs added up together only produce this amount of money, you know, Israel money to candidates. And that's true. But what the article points out is most of the money is given by individual people who get together with their other millionaire friends, bundle a ton of money, and then give it to members of Congress to buy them. It's the first time I've ever seen it explained. There's even a story in it how they, even in tiny places, at least for terms of Jewish community, like Lubbock, Texas, mm-hmm. which is named in the article, they have 12 people together. And they say, okay, we're going to pool our money and we're going to buy our congressman. I mean, it's just, that's the thing that stands out to me. And the backdrop of the article for me is this awful, this Gaza slaughter that's been going on. Mm-hmm. The United States hasn't criticized Israel at all. In fact, we keep sending them the weapons to continue to perpetrate the slaughter. So I think, and that wouldn't be happening if AIPAC didn't control our foreign policy on the Middle East. So I think the article is great for anyone who just wants to understand how it works and that it's totally bipartisan. One side's as bad as the other, and we're truly screwed.
Yeah. Now, see, that's the thing of it to me is when you talk about all the bundling and all the organization and AIPAC as this kind of shadow pack that just sort of helps organize the other packs and that kind of thing. I think what you're telling me, MJ, as a real expert on this matter, I mean, you can say definitively about this kind of thing. You can measure it from where you're sitting. What you're basically telling me is they have a complete lock on the Congress. The American people, other than the Israel lobby, are basically helpless on any Middle East policy. We have no say in it whatsoever because they decide. And as it says in this article here, they're even to the right of the Israeli government on any given issue and are perfectly willing to be, too.
Yeah, I mean, one thing that was really striking to me was Netanyahu, I think this is a year ago, or 2013, Netanyahu was speaking to the AIPAC conference. And, you know, almost the entire Congress shows up for their big dinner. No other lobby comes close to having this. We're talking about hundreds of members of Congress who show up there to honor the Prime Minister of Israel. So, and they jump up and they stand up and they cheer for anything he says. And at one point, he gave lip service to the idea of peace with the Palestinians. Just lip service. He doesn't mean it. That confused the AIPAC crowd. What does that mean? We're not for peace. So they're totally silent when he expected applause for the idea of peace. And he said, it's okay, you can applaud. I mean,
We're all just playing.
We're just playing, and you're a bunch of, and you know, you're my agents, you know, you AIPAC are the agents, and Congress are your puppets, and here's what you can applaud, and here's what you can't applaud. It's just awful. Another story that was pretty shocking in there was about how this year, Congress was going out for the summer and it had some big items on the agenda that were needed to, you know, they needed to get finished before they go away for that long break. One of them was a legislation to deal with the immigration issue with all those kids at our borders. And, you know, an emergency measure, something that most people and people of both parties wanted, but they couldn't get around to it. So they adjourned anyway, and then somebody realized, oh, my God, we have to give more money to Israel to help them fight the war. So they come back the next day with only five members of Congress actually on the floor, in the Senate, and they just pass it unanimously. So the top priority of the United States government this July, number one priority, was getting Israel more aid because they were in the middle of this war they started. Yep. I mean, come on.
Well, and you know, this is, I don't know of any other interest in Washington, D.C. that's been pushing for America to support the rebels against Assad this whole time, even when we've known for 3 years straight now that these guys are the cousins of the 9/11 attackers, the al-Nusra Front and then ISIS. And it's only because that's what Israel wants, as far as I can tell, MJ.
If Israel wanted us to be going after IS or ISIS, we'd be going after them. Israel is perfectly content with ISIS there. ISIS is not a threat to them, per se. They have no long-term vision. Of course, it is a threat to them in the long term, but they don't think that way. They think in terms of, you know, they only think in terms of the Palestinians. So, no, if AIPAC wanted to make a priority the anti-Assad rebels and ISIS, they would have, but we would have. But AIPAC's not interested in it, so ISIS and those guys, they get a pass.
I don't know if you've seen
it's kind of, if you think about it, it's kind of amazing because if you think of it from U.S. interests, IS says their enemy is everybody, including the United States. I mean, they say they want to raise their flag over the White House and everything. Okay, and that's what the caliphate means. I mean, it's a bunch of crap, that language. They're not really any kind of real caliphate, but that's the language they use, which implies they're looking for control, you know, to beat everybody and do terrorism everywhere. Hamas, on the other hand, is only interested in one spot of land, Palestine. And yet it's Hamas that is the enemy of the entire United States Congress, and it's IS that they're not interested in.
Right.
It's just, it's crazy.
Well, and in fact, it's kind of ironic. It looks to me like they're basically, I mean, I'll call it in my own terms, maybe not legal definition, but I don't know, at least lowercase t treason that they've been guilty of the last 3 years, supporting those loyal to bin Laden and Zawahiri, or, you know, up until, you know, April 2013, they were loyal to Zawahiri anyway. And then the ISIS that broke off from Nusra, they're even worse than Nusra and along the very same lines. So, but it seems to me like because that's what Israel wants, and because they dominate Washington, D.C. so thoroughly that Assad and Iran and Hezbollah are the enemy at all costs, as Michael Oren said, I prefer these bad guys to those bad guys because those bad guys are backed by Iran and all that. That's actually the only thing that's keeping us from a full-scale war against the Islamic State right now. It's actually helping to keep the peace because their lying narrative is so damn confused at this point. They don't know what to do. They're trying to figure out how to paper over their pivot back, by saying, well, you know, we should have backed the moderates more and whatever, whatever. But basically, everybody can tell. A year ago, they wanted to overthrow Assad, which would have only benefited ISIS. So how do they admit that they have to change their mind now? They can only do it in such a slow, clumsy way that at least it's taking them a while to get the war started. You know, I mean, it could be worse because of their treason.
Well, you know, AIPAC is not, you know, if AIPAC was really running this one, this whole ISIS-Syria thing, it would be different because they're much more efficient. Yeah, the administration is just like bumbling along. But when AIPAC decides to target Iran, you know it.
Right.
There's like one line from the United States Congress: Iran is the enemy. And it's, but you know, this one, they're a little bit confused. And it is really remarkable that the Israelis do not perceive the threat from ISIS. I mean, really? Really? You don't think that these guys, after they took out Syria, wouldn't go over and take out Jordan? And they're next door to Israel?
But well, maybe they just want an excuse to, excuse to annex the East Bank of the Jordan River too there.
Yeah, but either annex it. No, I don't think it's annex it. I think it would be eventually to drive the Palestinians into it.
Oh, yeah, there you go.
And then they say, you know, that's the old Ariel Sharon thing. Jordan is the Palestinian state.
Right.
You know, and if the ISIS took over, we could say, okay, why don't you just go over there? It's just, the whole thing is just so crazy, and it's hard to imagine what American policy on the Middle East would be if this lobby didn't exist. All we know is it would be very different than what we see now. And maybe the president of the United States might have said one single word about the 500 Palestinian kids killed in Gaza. Not a word. It's just awesome, the complete control that they have.
Right. And again, this article in the New Yorker. And what's the author's name? I know you know her.
Her name is Connie Brook.
Connie Brook, right.
And her husband is former Congressman Mel Levine, who was very, very close from California, who was very, very close to the lobby. So she knows what she's talking about.
Oh,
not only from the interviews, but she also is married to some guy who served in Congress and knows these people.
Right. Well, so, I mean, and some of the quotes in here, MJ, we cannot let Israel determine when and where the U.S. goes to war. That's Dianne Feinstein talking. Holy crap. And I've heard that one before, but I have forgotten it at least. And there's some others like that where the Congress is really expressing in their own words, some very powerful members of the House and the Senate expressing in their own words just how wrapped up in what AIPAC wants they are. And whether they're struggling with it or whether they're wholly loyal to it or whatever, the context here is just really enlightening, I think, for people.
You know, I think that, remember that part in the article about that young congressman from Texas who voted against the extra money for Israel last month, and it had this whole part about how the other congressman said, "Don't do it, don't do it."
Right.
It should be the end of you. And he says, I wish I remembered his name because he deserves some publicity. He said, no, I got to do it. And he voted right. Now he says, well, he thinks he'll be all right. He thinks he'll win. But AIPAC is going after him.
Right. No exceptions. They can't let him make an example.
It doesn't matter who you are, what you do. You guess right.
And the attacks on Wasserman Schultz, that was the one that exploded my brain, was the way that they went after her for standing with the president on the Iran talks.
Yeah, she is. And she is like totally them. She is, I would say she's the queen of AIPAC. But when she supported her president, they threatened her too.
Mercilessly.
Nobody who's immune
and where
to
she
it.
Says, me? You know, it's that quote, you would do this to me? Yeah, they would.
Yeah, and of course that implies it's okay for them to do it to all the people who are not her.
Right.
But me, Debbie Wasserman Schultz, I'm a wholly owned subsidiary of you. Yep. I mean, it's pretty remarkable. I mean, it's quite a remarkable lobby because I can't think, well, first of all, even the word lobby barely does anything. I mean, it doesn't come close to talking about how powerful it is. But this is one that's both parties completely. You know, if you look at other lobbies, manufacturing, gun lobbies, whatever, they're chamber of commerce, environmental lobby, they're usually one party or the other. This is everybody in both parties. So if someone says, well, I'm going to join the alternative lobby, mm-hmm. There is no alternative lobby. It's AIPAC. You want to be involved in this issue? It's AIPAC. And that's not true of any other lobby. You'll hear debates on these issues on the Sunday shows. Sometimes they'll go back and forth. There's no back and forth on this issue. There's one side. And if you're on the other side, and by the other side, I would say I make the threshold very low. If you're on the other side, i.e., you have compassion for the people of Gaza, you're anti-American, you're anti-Israel, and you're anti-Semitic. That's how bad it is.
Yep.
And I know, because I get called all those things.
Well,
but I don't care.
Now, here's the thing, as long as I'm keeping you through the break here, a little over time, MJ, one of the things that really stands out here is the shame of Barack Obama and how terrified he is to stand up to Netanyahu. And really the chutzpah of Netanyahu, where his attitude is like, I don't care what you're the president of. No, you heard me. No. And gimme. And Obama can't do anything, basically, but what he says. And, I mean, that's not really true. I guess the part of the story here is that Obama is getting his way on Iran. But still, it's shocking enough, the story of just how hard Netanyahu and AIPAC, acting on his behalf, pushed back has tried to sabotage the talks.
They think they can wait it out till Hillary Clinton gets there. Hillary Clinton is totally with them on the Iran thing. She has taken every opportunity to talk about, to take a harder line than Obama. Netanyahu and that whole crew are banking on Hillary Clinton being the next president. And then, look, George W. Bush would not allow them to attack Iran. Obama wouldn't allow them to attack Iran. Hillary Clinton will allow them to attack Iran. I have no doubt about that, because I don't think there's anyone, any candidate who's ever run for president of this country who was as much in AIPAC's pocket as Hillary Clinton. And in other words, you ain't seen nothing yet.
Oh, man. All right. Well, thanks very much. I'm sorry I kept you so far over time, but
great
talking to you again, MJ.
Take care.
You too. All right. That's MJ Rosenberg, y'all. He's on Twitter at MJ, like Homer J. Simpson, MJ Rosenberg. And, I'm about to tweet him, so you can find his Twitter address there. And also his website is mjrosenberg.com, and you can find him at the Huffington Post. And he is mentioned in this new article at the New Yorker, which is just chock full of insights, even though there are some omissions, but still it's good. It's by Connie Brook at the New Yorker. Friends of Israel, are American Jews turning against AIPAC? And now I can hit the button and see if I can get Dar Jamail on the show. Where are we at on the music here? We're back. Just finishing up with MJ there. Calling Dar Jamail. All right, good deal. We got Dar on the line. Dar Jamail, if you guys are familiar, or if you're not, or both, He was an unembedded reporter during the worst days of the last Iraq war over there. He wrote a couple of books about it, Beyond the Green Zone and The Courage to Resist. That's about AWOL soldiers and conscientious objectors and stuff like that. He's done a hell of a lot of great work, heroic and incredibly brave work over the years, reporting about the various Iraq wars and all the death at the hands of the American Empire over there. Welcome back to the show, Dar. How are you doing?
Thanks, Scott. I'm good. Good to be with you.
Good, good. Very happy to have you here. I almost don't know where to begin asking you about what you think about what's going on in the land formerly known as Iraq right now. But I guess I'll just go ahead, and if I'm throwing darts at topics, I'll start with the new prime minister, Abadi. What can you tell us about him, and what can you tell us about what it means that America's gotten another regime change there, at least partially, and replaced Nouri al-Maliki with this new guy, Abadi?
Well, it's in sum, I would lead by saying, meet the new boss, same as the old boss. This is a guy who was close with Maliki. He was appointed by Maliki into a ministerial position when Maliki was in power. Again, we have yet another phenomena happening, the same thing that did when Maliki was brought in, where I think it was Patrick Coburn who coined the phrase, you know, this is a guy who both the great Satan and the axis of evil agreed on, being the U.S. and in Iran, and it happened with Maliki and it's happened with Abadi. And so this is a guy, he's from Maliki's Dawa, he's in Maliki's Dawa party. So again, if he's a guy who is backed by the West, therein lies the problem, because one of the big problems that the Iraqi government faces is a crisis of legitimacy, because when the general population sees them as being appointed or okayed or rubber stamped by the West, then they don't have legitimacy. So this is why when ISIS initially rolled into Iraq from Syria, and the Iraqi military just started laying down its weapons and taking off their uniforms and running away, they're not willing to fight and die for a government that they don't believe in. So therein lies the problem.
Mm-hmm. All right, now, isn't it right, and maybe this is overstating it, maybe there's a lot of nuance here I don't understand or something, Dar, but I thought that the Iranian and Supreme Islamic Council and Dawa Party policy always has been that they want what Joe Biden calls strong federalism. They want secession. And, you know, maybe they don't want IS ruling Sunni stand. They would rather have a coalition of Sunni tribal leaders or something like that. But wasn't it always the case that the Iranians figured if they could get America to give them Baghdad, then great. But just like you said, they just melted away. They turned and fled from Mosul because it wasn't their territory. It was foreign land that they were holding. They had no real backup there. So they retreated back to Shiistan. And so I just wonder whether, if the whole, well, first of all, if that's right, then that leads to the question of whether replacing Maliki means a damn thing, because they've tried to portray it like it's just his, you know, idiocy and intransigent personality, his thick skull, basically, that can't get it right, that he's got to be nicer to the Sunnis so that they'll turn on these Al-Qaeda types. But I just wonder whether, you know, that's in the party agenda, whether that's in the Quds Force's agenda here at all or not, you know?
Well, it's an interesting point. I mean, and you know, there could be a lot to that. But, you know, and I guess we'd have to wait and see regarding what happened in Iraq, whether, you know, if there's a big march by ISIS on Baghdad, how does the military, the Iraqi military respond in that case? But, you know, we need to go back, I think, also talking about,
mean, do they have an incentive? Do they care to try to bribe the Sunni tribes and get along with them, incorporate them, achieve any of those failed benchmarks of cooperation from back in 07? Do they have any incentive to be nice guy Maliki now any more than they did under Maliki, the idiot and the bad guy?
Well, it's a good question. I really can't answer that. But one thing I wanted to enter into this discussion, because I think it is directly related, is that, you know, quote from the intelligence firm Stratfor, where they released a report several years ago that basically said that quote, the new government's attempts to establish control over all of Iraq, the new government being the new government in Iraq early on in the occupation, may well lead to a civil war between Sunni, Shia, and Kurdish ethnic groups. The fiercest fighting could be expected for control over the oil facilities, which is exactly what we're seeing right now. And then we have to talk about the Biden plan of partitioning Iraq into three rump states, as you just alluded to. So that's also going on in concert with the push, the tug of war between between Iran and U.S. plans in the region. So could those two things happening simultaneously not be self-reinforcing?
Right. Well, yeah, so when it comes to the Sunni-Shia civil war, America's still on both sides over there, and I guess will be for as long as they can. And maybe part of it is just their unwillingness to call it what it is, right? Oh, yeah, well, you know, we're trying to take Iran down a peg by backing the rebels in Syria. Not that we're trying to take the Shia down a peg by supporting the Mujahideen, the rebels in Syria. No, not at all, because they just refuse to look at it that way. They call it the people of Syria and whatever crap, and they like to believe it, but what they're really doing is, sometimes they back Iran and sometimes they back Osama's guys.
Well, that's right. I mean, the U.S., and this is something I hope we can get into a little bit, where the political situation that the U.S. is in is absolutely untenable. They have made themselves quite the bed in Iraq and Syria, where on the one hand, it's clear that there's no way, given, you know, the stuff that's coming out about how effective fighting force ISIS is, you know, this is even coming from within the U.S. military. They're being called a, quote, incredible fighting force, according to a U.S. special ops source, and looking at how they're effectively taking and holding ground, making very smart tactical retreats when the airstrikes ramp up against them. And so it's clear, my point is, it's clear that there's nothing short of a full-scale ground military operation is what would be necessary to destabilize and remove this group, i.e. So politically, how do you work that in the U.S.? So you've got Obama, you know, making bombing runs in Iraq, now having squabbles with trying to get permission from the Assad government to do the same in Syria. Mm-hmm. Whether or not they adhere to that is something to be seen. But doing what it can politically, because politically there's nothing to support across the population of the United States any kind of another big ground incursion into Iraq or Syria, and yet that's what they have to do. So what are they going to do? And now we're about to go into the ramping up of the 2016 campaign season. So Obama's, of course, mindful of that. The DNC, well, we can't afford that. That would basically lose us the election to have another big ground incursion. So what are they going to do?
Man, I really don't know either. I mean, I guess I still have to conclude that they're sending in the whole damn Marine Corps eventually, because, like you're saying, just as the logical argument, they got no way out of it. They cannot let, and I'm not saying this, but I'm saying from Washington, D.C.'s point of view, they cannot let this stand, and they cannot wait for anybody else to do anything about it, for the Sunnis of Iraq and Syria to do anything about it, for any of the neighbors to do anything about it. They got to be the ones to do something about it. And it could just mean, I don't know, carpet bombing with B-1s for another 10 years or whatever, try to contain them that way. But it seems like the most likely explanation is they're going to send in some force of mercenaries or Marines or somebody to sack Mosul before New Year's, because what the hell are they going to do? You just said, what are they going to do? They're going to let this place exist when no one else can field an army to dislodge them? And I'm sorry, because I'm not trying to give them a casus belli. I know I sound like it, but I'm just saying from their point of view, they've argued themselves and policied themselves into this trap, and it's a damn mess. And I'm sorry, we got to stop here. We'll be right back with the great Dar Jamail on the other side of this break, y'all. Hey, Al, Scott Horton here to tell you about this great new book by Michael Swanson, The War State. In The War State, Swanson examines how Presidents Truman, Eisenhower, and Kennedy both expanded and fought to limit the rise of the new national security state after World War II. This nation is ever to live up to its creed of liberty and prosperity for everyone. We are going to have to abolish the empire. Know your enemy. Get The War State by Michael Swanson. It's available at your local bookstore or at Amazon.com in Kindle or in paperback. Just click the book in the right margin at ScottHorton.org or TheWarState.com. All right, you guys, welcome back. These kooks at the Brookings Institution are tweeting out about how we got to build up a new moderate rebel army in Syria. No, 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 this isn't a rerun. This is live in the end of August 2014. We got to build up a moderate army to defeat Assad and ISIS. You see, writes Ken Pollack. Ken Pollack, the guy who, along with his counterpart, R2-D2 to his C-3PO, Robert O'Hanlon, wrote the threatening storm for the Council on Foreign Relations that shored up all the liberal interventionist part of the establishment for the invasion of Iraq in 2003. Now he's saying, oops, he accidentally turned over the entire north and west of Iraq to a bunch of little Osamas. And so now we got to build up a war of build up an army of a little bit less Osamas to fight these this army of horrible Osamas. Because the last thing we got to do, according to him, according to Brookings, is support Assad, because Israel hates Assad. Right, Dar?
You can't make this stuff up, Scott. It's astounding to me. I'm shaking my head every day where literally these guys, the U.S. government is now in talks with the Syrian government that they, you know, dovetailing on everything you just said. That's what this was all about, getting rid of Assad for the U.S. and for Israel. And now they're trying to work in conjunction with him to battle ISIS, which they also helped create. I mean, this is something, it's like Catch-22 on steroids at this point. It's really amazing to me that the policy is so incoherent that these people clearly have no idea what they're doing. They're letting different political factions make these different calls, often in conflict with one another, as we're seeing so clearly now. I mean, it's really stupefying to me to understand that here's the U.S. continuing to support the government in Baghdad, shipping in massive amounts of money and training and weapons, as they have been for the last 8+ years, now in talks with the Syrian government to work in conjunction with them there, still funneling in arms and weapons to these quote-unquote moderate groups that you just very well pointed out, all at the same time, and literally funding and fueling all sides of the contact, either directly or indirectly.
Yeah. Well, you know, I saw Robert Baer on CNN. He's a former CIA guy and pretty hawkish on a lot of things. He's no Giraldi or McGovern when it comes to former CIA guys. But I saw them ask him, so what do we do over here? And he said, man, you know, I don't know, maybe nothing. He said, my entire career, I've never seen the Middle East this bad like this. And I don't know how it's going to shake out. And I don't see who we can line up with against these guys. And so maybe, I don't know. At another time, he said it would take 1 million men 100 years. That was a couple of weeks ago. And that's a guy who's a pretty bad hawk when it comes to this stuff. And, you know, we'll turn right around and blame 9/11 on Iran or God knows what, you know?
But, well, it's Iraq and Syria are two completely failed states. And I would second what he said. If someone said, what's the... When people ask me, well, what is the solution? I say, A, I don't know, but B, the logical first step is the U.S. absolutely cannot have a role in it because they created the whole problem. And so the U.S. absolutely can't be part of it. And yet, politically now, they are forced into it to where they have to be, or at least they think they have to be. And so, and a lot of the world community thinks they have to be, and a lot of the people on the ground think they have to be. But it's an untenable situation, and you know, we've got now a giant swath of territory smack in the middle of the Middle East that is completely controlled by ISIS, and they are getting stronger, and they're getting more fighters by the day. They're getting more public support on the ground thanks to the U.S. airstrikes that are and Iraqi airstrikes that are ongoing. You know, hundreds of people being killed on a daily basis at this point. I mean, 212 killed today across Iraq, and about the same number wounded. It's astounding the amount of bloodshed that's happening there, and it seems like it can only ramp up.
Well, so here's something we got some experience with from the Iraq War. Well, especially you. I was safe back here in Texas the whole time. But what about the tension between the tribal systems and those who are trying to create this Islamic caliphate here? It seems like a pretty severe challenge of you know, modes of authority, and I wonder, you know, what you think. If, well, I don't know, for the medium term, say the immediate crisis kind of dies down, we have sort of a all things being equal situation within the new caliphate, within Sunnistan, I wonder who you think really has the upper hand there between the tribes and the Islamists.
It's so complex and it's so chaotic that I think you have to talk about which specific area, because in some areas of Anbar province, if we can still call it that, but just geographically so folks understand what I'm talking about, in some areas there, tribes are in control. In other areas, ISIS is clearly in total control. And in a lot of areas, it's contested. And then there's some instances where definitely tribal leadership has been working in concert with ISIS. And then in other areas where they're directly in opposition. So I think that's just another example of how chaotic and how complex and how dynamic the situation is, even on a daily and sometimes hourly basis.
Yeah. Well, Lord knows there's a lot of people still to be killed. I mean, it seems like a lot of the vacuum has been filled at this point. But then there are questions like Kirkuk and, who's going to end up dominating that? There's a long battle line, long border between the Islamic State and Kurdistan right now.
That's right. And I think it's very important, the fact of how much violence occurred in Kirkuk. I believe it was just yesterday, several massive car bombs went off.
Yeah.
That can be expected to continue. That's contested. I mean, at the end of the day, this is all going to come down to oil, as it always does. And ISIS understands clearly, you can see by what they've done in Syria, that they need to gain control of and keep control of as much of the oil infrastructure as possible in both countries. And Kirkuk is absolutely frontline material, and I think we can expect a whole lot of things to continue to degrade there.
Yep. Well, and then, part of this is going back to war for the Shiite militias, for, for Assad and for the Iranian access that Bush has got us fighting for most of the time. I mean, he was fighting, creating great circumstances for the bin Ladenites too, don't get me wrong. But now that we're pivoting back, redirecting back again to the Wolfowitz policy of empowering Iran here, Eric Garris has just written me in the IM here about a Pentagon spokesman all but admitted that they are working with Assad now. And when they asked him the difference between disclosing airstrikes in Iraq and those in Syria, he said, well, in Iraq, there has been an overt ask of the government for us to intervene, where in Syria they're still holding it under their chest. But anyway, so America has bought the caliphate's premise now that, you're right, that border no longer exists. Let's fight.
And this is just amazing. I mean, again, I'm just shaking my head, where this was all about getting rid of Assad, and now we're working with him.
Yep. Well, and I guess we'll be switching back again, too. Whoever knows? I mean, if you go back to America's relationship with Assad's father and that kind of thing, your brain will explode. Got a smoke bowl. Come down. All right. Thanks a lot. Appreciate your time, Dar.
Thanks, Scott.
Good talk to you again. That's the great Dar Jamil, everybody. We'll be right back.
Hey, all, Scott here. Ever wanted to help support the show and own silver at the same time? Well, a friend of mine, libertarian activist Arlo Pignatti, has invented the alternative currency with the most promise of them all. QR Silver Commodity Discs, the first ever QR code 1 ounce silver pieces. Just scan the back of one with your phone and get the instant spot price. They're perfect for saving or spending at the market. And anyone who donates $100 or more to the Scott Horton Show at scotthorton.org/donate gets one. That's scotthorton.org/donate. And if you'd like to learn and order more, send them a message at commoditydiscs.com or check them out on Facebook at /commoditydiscs. And thanks.
What in the world? Adam Weinstein from Gawker just tweeted out, Douglas MacArthur McCain, could there be any name less befitting a jihadist? No, John McCain was as bad as Dick Cheney in the run-up to the Iraq War. John McCain was a should-have-gone all the way to Baghdad in 91 hawk all through the 90s. Was on board with Richard Perle and the Project for a New American Century and a regime change in Iraq from the time of the Iraq Liberation Act. In fact, I bet you if I put in Iraq Liberation Act and a picture and see Bill Clinton signing it, that John McCain will be standing there right behind him. Let's see. Iraq Liberation Act, 1998. Search Google Images. And there's Bill, and nope, that's Netanyahu and Arafat. That's not it. Oh, Freedom Agenda. Nope, that's not it. Oops. Come on, show me a picture of Bill Clinton signing the damn thing. All right, fine. I'll search videos then. For Bill Clinton signing the Iraq Liberation Act. Well, there he is talking about it. Show him sitting at the desk signing the damn thing, you jerks. All right, well, anyway, John McCain was in on it all along. It's John McCain's fault as much as anyone else that lawless North and Western Iraq has been jihadistan since 2003. And it's John McCain's responsibility as much as anyone else that Syria, Eastern and Northern Syria, have been turned into jihadistan since 2011. There is no more fitting a name of an American for this kook who went and got himself shot serving the enemy over there in the Islamic State. He was just doing what his namesake encouraged, fighting Assad. For Adam Weinstein to just be completely oblivious to that? Could there be any name less befitting a jihadist, he asks. Oh, come on now, Adam. Don't be so obtuse, man. But anyway, you can be obtuse if you want, you know. The only one I know about it. This should be fun. I think this is going to be great.
This crisis also demonstrates, unfortunately, once again, that Saddam Hussein remains an impediment to the well-being of his people and a threat to the peace of his region and the security of the world. We will continue to contain the threat that he poses by working for the elimination of Iraq's weapons of mass destruction capability under UNSCOM, enforcing the sanctions in the no-fly zone, responding firmly to any Iraqi provocations. However, over the long term, the best way to address that threat is through a government in Baghdad, a new government that is committed to represent and respect its people, not repress them, that is committed to peace in the region. Over the past year, we have deepened our engagement with the forces of change in Iraq, reconciling the two largest Kurdish opposition groups, beginning broadcasts of a Radio Free Iraq throughout the country. We will intensify that effort, working with Congress to implement the Iraq Liberation Act, which was recently passed, strengthening our political support to make sure the opposition, or to do what we can to make the opposition, a more effective voice for the aspirations of the Iraqi people. Let me say again, what we want and what we will work for is a government in Iraq that represents and respects its people, not represses them, and one committed to live in peace with its neighbors. In the century we are leaving, America has often made the difference between tyranny and freedom.
Oh, God almighty. Spare me. I will spare you now. I'm sorry. That's Bill Clinton announcing his Iraq Liberation Act and all the good that's going to flow from it. That was when it officially became American policy to seek regime change. Anyway, I don't know. Maybe I should make this a TV show. It seems like every day I want to take a stick and point at a map and go, look, man, see, these guys are here and those guys are here, and this is what Bush and Bill and Bush and Obama have done to these people. Mark Weisbrot wrote an article one time called Our Own Holocaust Denial. 1 million dead Iraqis. And we just pretend to ignore it. Very, very, very broad use of the term we. But he was speaking for the U.S. and the U.K. populations as a whole, and especially the political classes. Oh, how many Iraqis died in that thing? Are we counting that? Do we care about that? How many civilians die in our experiments with their societies? Yeah. No. You know, Weisbrod is absolutely right about that. There's very few in media who will ever even talk about Iraqi casualties, the discrepancies, the different groups that have counted up various numbers at various times and try to compare them, try to come up with a good estimate. No one even cares. They don't even care. I knew a pro-war guy who, in 2004, I said, a new study just came out, said more than 100,000 people have died. And he looked at me and said, what? Oh, my God. And he really believed, no, we're going to totally fix up Iraq and make it a better place for everybody over there and all this stuff. He still believed that halfway through 2004. I don't know. I said, man, a new Lancet Johns Hopkins report just came out, said 100,000 people have died. And he was aghast, and I said, okay, so if that's at the upper limit of what's acceptable to you, what's intolerable? And why is it up to you? Isn't this crazy? How many dead Iraqis are you willing to tolerate to see if this experiment plays out well? Can't cut and run now. The violence will get worse, they said. But they refused to acknowledge what was the mission. The mission was to make the violence worse. The mission was to steal Baghdad for not the Shiites, for the Dawah Party and the Supreme Islamic Council to kick the Sunnis out of it with drill holes in their corpses' skulls and take it. What? We can't cut and run from that mission to help Iran and the mullahs run away with Baghdad? Sure to lead to 1,000 years worth of revenge consequences flowing down the line? Now, how in the world do you figure stopping that policy, stopping, you know, going along with that policy, would make matters worse? Boy, that was the official position of the Libertarian Party, too, back then. Oh, no, we can't leave now, not until we've made everything okay. Really, huh? Well, they stayed through 2011, and they didn't make everything okay. Not at all. And I admit, if you read my article, Finding Ways to Stay in Iraq, from February of 2009, I did underestimate the ability of Al-Qaeda in Iraq to rise back up to the top of the rank of power among the Sunni tribes. But how could I have imagined that Barack Obama would back the Mujahideen in their wars against the secular, clean-shaven, chin-having military dictators Qaddafi and Assad? That he would commit high treason on behalf of those who were sworn loyal to Ayman al-Zawahiri and al-Qaeda? And that would lead to such blowback in Sunni Iraq? Not in my wildest dreams could I have imagined that Obama would have gone so far. And then again, that is what Israel wanted, so. Hey, Al Scott here for MyHeroesThink.com. They sell beautiful 7-inch busts of libertarian heroes Ludwig von Mises, Murray Rothbard, Ron Paul, and Harry Brown. These finely crafted statues from MyHeroesThink.com make excellent decorations for your desktop at work, bookends for your shelves, or gifts for that special individualist in your life. They're also all available in colors now, too. Of course, gold, silver, or bronze. Coming soon, Hayek, Hazlitt, Carlin. Use promo code Scott Horton and save $5 at MyHeroesThink.com. All right, you guys, wrapping up the show here today. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, The Scott Horton Show. Hey, and if you're still listening to this now, then you must love me. So I won't be quite so embarrassed to ask you for money. I need money. I got expenses, and I got to pay for them. And really, more than donations and subscriptions, as great as they are, and I don't mean to discourage them, but as great as they are, what I really need is new and more advertisers. I charge hardly anything for ads. I could make you a great deal for some ads. You want to advertise on the show? Associate your thing with my thing? You know, you could try. If you got a business or a nonprofit organization, some kind of peace group, or, you know, go-kart parts or whatever. No, I already have a go-kart parts sponsor. Thank you very much. But anything else? unless it's something horrible. Actually, a guy said, hey, you know what? I'm working with this guy. He's running for office. Can we do political advertising on your show? He's a very Ron Paulian libertarian Republican. I said, I'm sorry, I can't do that. No, I'm afraid. No, I can't take money to vouch for a politician. That would be wrong. My audience might think that I'm corrupt and evil, and then they probably wouldn't like me anymore, so. Otherwise, I'm very open-minded. If you want to advertise on the show, advertise on the show. Otherwise, go to scotthorton.org/donate, and you can find out how to sign up for monthly subscriptions of 5, 10, 20, 100, 200, $500, whatever you like. Well, okay, I'm pushing it. Monthly subscriptions, automatic debit kind of thing. Or you can just do a single payment of whatever you like. But especially email me, scott@scotthorton.org, if you'd like to advertise on the show. Oh, yeah, I forgot to say, anybody who donates $100 or more, I'll send you a commodity disc. And by the way, I don't pay a bunch extra for tracking and insurance and all this stuff. So if anybody ever doesn't get their commodity disc, let me know and I'll send you another one. But give them a few days. It is the U.S. government mail. See, it's a crime to compete with them in letter delivery. So if I was sending you something bigger in a package, then I could go to the competition. But I guess I could go to UPS for this. Go price comparison. Anyway, if anybody ever doesn't get their coin, let me know. But I am very good about sending them out. I will have you know. The commodity disc, it's a 1-ounce silver piece with a QR code on the back. So you take a picture of it, you scan it with your phone, get a QR code scanner app for free, and you scan it with your phone, and it tells you the instant spot price right there. You don't need to know the face value. You have an instant face value and know exactly how much it's worth at any given time, which is brilliant, which is the most wonderful thing ever, ever. CommodityDiscs.com, and I'll send you a free one if you donate more than $100. And that's right. I hate to say it, because it should be all out of the goodness of my heart and everything. But the truth is, just like you and everybody else, I got to make money so that I can spend money on living. And the cost just keeps going up and up. So there you go. Sorry for beating you over the head, but that's the way it is. ScottHorton.org/donate if you're into that. And here's why to support the show. Because I hate stuff like this, and we'll cover it for you. I'm sorry. To me, this is just the end of the world. I just don't know what, and I don't mean in a magical religious way. Just, this is so damn depressing. National progressives want a quote, federal czar to oversee local police forces. That's it. Man, I thought Homeland Security and all its fusion and all the multi-jurisdictional task forces, for that matter, hell, the FBI. You thought that was a national police force. You thought those were national police forces. This is the end of your local police. As horrible as they are, oh no, they're not going away. They are going to be nationalized in the name of Mike Brown. You see how government works, liberals? This is why libertarians are libertarians. Because we understand that government doesn't mind failing horribly, doing the wrong thing and creating catastrophe, because they have a monopoly. We have no right to fire them and replace them. And so they are the only ones who benefit. The only answer to anything they ever do wrong is more money and more power for them. Virtually always. That's why when they fought and fought and fought and then they finally allowed the 9/11 Commission. Do you remember in 2002 how it went? 2003, how it went? By the time they created the commission, it was as plain as day. It was all over all the statements and all the newspapers and all over TV. This isn't about investigating everything about the attack. This is I think Bush even used the phrase, this was me paraphrasing him somehow closely. This is an outcome-based commission. He announced that on the first day. He said at the end, they are going to recommend that we create a Department of Homeland Security. Right? How in the world did everyone at the FBI, NSA, CIA, and all of the everybody on the National Security Council, all the War Cabinet, everybody, none of them were held accountable for September 11th happening on their watch. None of them. At all. None of them. But then the investigation into, well, how come it happened on your watch then, only served to be the excuse to pass the Department of Homeland Security Act. That's it. That's all it was. And here we have this catastrophe in Ferguson and in every county and every city in America now, where they are armed up with M4s and tanks and MRAPs and body armor, and they're trained like they're special forces kill teams. It's what they call death squads in America in the 21st century. And because the Pentagon and the federal government gave them all of this stuff, all of this military training, and all of the equipment, and now we've got a problem with them running roughshod and killing unarmed, especially young black men, all the time across America, there's only one thing to do: nationalize them. According to, even the ACLU has signed on to this. I mean, Jesus, I know about centrist liberal nationalism, and yes, there is kind of an indisputable record of federal intervention in the 1860s and in the 1960s against local and state oppression of blacks, and how there is therefore a tradition on the, you know, left liberal side of American politics that the national government is the solution to all your problems, even when you know they're the cause. Even when everybody knows these cops got all this training and all this equipment from the Pentagon, that's not even in question where they got this stuff, where the policy comes from. But still, the only solution can be to put them all under a czar. And in fact, look at even the way that they set up the fake false question here. They say, if somebody isn't tasked with ensuring the implementation of equitable policing and blah, blah, blah. Right, equitable. Let's go ahead and enslave us all as bad as poor blacks, poor politically powerless blacks in the ghetto. As long as everything is equally oppressive, then fine, right? But anyway, that's not even the point. The way they phrase the question, not if nobody is tasked, but if somebody, singular, isn't tasked, then it's not going to get done. And so, ready? Quote, the administration must appoint a federal czar. You know, that's Russian for Caesar, for Kaiser, for dictator. A federal czar housed in the U.S. Department of Justice, who is specifically tasked with promoting the professionalization of local law enforcement. And all they say they want in here is, oh, you know, maybe a little bit of rollback of how much equipment you give out, and closely regulate and monitor the use of all the equipment you've already distributed. There's not even a call here for the Pentagon to take back their machine guns and their MRAPs. At all. No, just only the national government that made it this way can be trusted with the implementation. So, there you go. At some point in the past, I don't know how far back you'd have to go, there would have been an American Revolution over this. An outright national police force. Taking 20,000 separate police jurisdictions and putting them all under a czar at the DOJ? Are you kidding me? They must be stopped. The ACLU signed on to this. Go read at BuzzFeed.com. Read their letter to Obama in the Washington Post today. Read it and weep.